When I was invited to teach, the thing that came to mind was, how could this be? This is such a humble process, this practice. And I realized in that moment that the humility had dipped down into the gratitude within my heart. And an intention arose. And the motivation to, of course, accept the honor came as well with the intention to keep the ethic of Dana alive. Because I had already heard that Dana, which is the first parami, is essential at the core of the infrastructure of Buddhism, and that without it, Buddhism will collapse. So in listening to Fred and the quality of his reflection, it helped me to remember that sense that we do find ourselves... Oh, thank you. through the sense of good fortune that is related to generosity to Dana, come more and more intimately close to the heart of compassion. And that inexplicable sense of the good fortune of having the Buddha's teachings as a way to reflect and to support our deepest sensitivity and sensibility. As I was reflecting on what I wanted to focus on during this time here in Santa Fe and in Albuquerque, I went into that sense of this gratitude. And the accompanying thing that came with this gratitude was this notion of living in the eye of the storm of our practice in a world of turbulence, of fear, of aggression. And what corresponded with this was as well that we each live within this world of fear and turbulence and aggression. It's right here. And that through my own particular experience, I can share the faith that this inner world of fear and turbulence and aggression is what we meet with compassion and equanimity. And in this way, it shifts our view not only of our own perceptual experience of the sense of self, but it helps us to understand as well that as practitioners, that we are essentially students of the First Noble Truth of suffering. When, in the day of the Buddha, people would come with their various practices, evidently, there were something like 42 different practices that were active at that time. And so with pride, and maybe as well with humility, people would bring their practices and say, how about this? And the Buddha had a very interesting response that one can find throughout the suttas, which is, I don't proclaim such things, I only proclaim the truth of suffering. There was this experience in something called the Pitapada Sutta, or the stages of consciousness, where this group of erudites came together and decided that they would evolve the most important and rarefied questions to bring to the Buddha. And so this particular individual was chosen as the spokesperson and came and asked the Buddha these various questions. And I frankly can't comprehend them. In reading the sutta, and he said, again, I don't proclaim such things. I only proclaim the truth of suffering, the causes, as well as cessation of the means. And that's really how we can understand this process that is arising out of within us, this inclination to the practice. We are responding to the first aspect of consciousness that arises at that shift in perspective. And that's this first aspect is intentionality, as well as students of the First Noble Truth of Suffering. We are more and more inclined to intention. And this is the role of the of mindfulness. And I'd like to talk about mindfulness as a way to enter into the topic of equanimity. Because in looking deeply into the heart of my own suffering and the suffering of the world, equanimity is that which allows for us to live in the eye of the storm, an environment of clarity, so that we can begin to discern the distinction between that which is harming and that which is free. At the very, very heart of the Buddhism, which is a practice-oriented doctrine, we hear about ahimsa, which is non-harming. We also hear that the critical factor in responding to this growing capacity to recognize the distinction between that which is harming and that which is not, or that which is wholesome and that which is not. We also hear about the critical factor associated with that which is sati or mindfulness. And a number of us teachers practicing for a while, you know, are wanting to share a little bit more about sati, since mindfulness has become a kind of floating world. Somebody asked a new paradigm. The critical factor that brings us into intentionality is related to sati. And sati can be understood in two ways. In a nuanced translation, it's to remember. There is a wonderful phrase that came out of Upandita the last time I sat with him, and perhaps the last time I ever will in this country. He's become sort of elderly and repeating the same things over and over again, like we find ourselves doing. But what he was repeating had to do with what he felt was of essence. And he kept repeating, remember that you are Appamana yogi in the pasture of Satipatthana. And I went, okay, but what does that mean? He said, remember, because otherwise, madness. So the first nuance of sati is remembering, and what we remember is intention. We remember intention because intention brings about a realignment of consciousness that slowly draws our attention into balance, equanimity, that opens this attention to mindful receptivity with what is. And this begins to provide the basis for the other nuance, which is participatory awareness. Participatory awareness, as an example, if the intention is to be with the process of breathing, and one's receptive awareness is within it, then we begin to experience the vedana or sensations unfolding in life that shift our perspective from thinking to a non-thinking awareness. And from here, equanimity, as it stabilizes, allows for the refinement and the distilling experience that galvanizes around qualities of consciousness, where slowly there's a relief from this egocentric centricity, where we're held within the view of the self, wanting, with the confusion that somehow life is supposed to be pleasant, to a different centricity, where our attention is drawn into and builds up that force that begins to be inclined to the cultivation of qualities of consciousness. This is one way of recognizing our practice and how it's working for us. Qualities of consciousness become important, don't they? And we begin to experience that humility that is not about understanding something, grasping it, holding it, digesting it. It's more built within the faith that this is enough, that this is enough, we're in transition. We who had this good fortune of hearing the Dhamma and being inclined in the way that I just have reflected upon are in a transition in view. So we are shifting in our view, and this first noble truth of suffering is the teaching. That it's our view of suffering that allows for us to experience increasing balance and clarity. It's not the view of self or other. It's the view of suffering and all the forms it takes within this configuration of consciousness called Deja and each of us here. And this is where equanimity begins to grow. It's said that within this remembering of intention and participatory awareness, and the term for that is bhavana or cultivation, we're actively engaged in cultivating that, which is balancing and wholesome. The force of equanimity begins to strengthen. And an interesting communication that I've had a few times with people who are intentionally cultivating equanimity will go something like this. Well, how is it going? I might be saying this. It always leads to some interesting response. I get, well, it's okay. Well, what do you mean okay? Well, everything is as it was, but now is as it is. And it's okay. It's somehow okay, and then the somehow leads to the physics of practice. Somehow there's more spaciousness. Somehow there's less patterns of reactivity. You know, somehow I don't want so much for my partner to be other than he or she is. Somehow. But the essence here is the stabilization of what we refer to as a confused view. The confused view is that there is a right and there's a wrong. I experienced this yesterday. That's silly to say I experienced it yesterday. I experience it all the time. But yesterday, in a particular way, that just as I was, I think I was about ready to eat something or drink something, and I could feel this restlessness and agitation, and every single moment within that particular view was about like and not like. It just corresponded with everything. It was spontaneously occurring on its own. And if I tune into that, like and not like, then I start drowning in the ocean of samsara. I start drowning because it's said that that tendency to think that our role is to figure out what's right and wrong and good and bad puts us within that mode where we get caught in isn't without any awareness of what is. What is this precious body is the foundation for the development of mindfulness. Giving rise to equanimity, that balancing factor that opens up the spacious awareness of consciousness that allows for there to be enough stability to choose how to respond to life. If there's too much static, then I lose that capacity to respond. I feel like a victim. I feel like I'm drowning in this ocean of samsara. Mindfulness and an equanimity move together in the way that our practice grows, because it's said out of it, each moment of this alignment between intention and attention, equanimity arises and begins to stabilize that restlessness. And that's what it is. We're trying to stabilize the existential restlessness that comes with life. It's called dukkha, the dukkha of birth. We're trying to, you know, stabilize this restlessness. And sometimes we hear or we experience in a moment that it's just life itself. We don't have to stabilize it, because we really wind up fighting against life without even knowing it. There's this line from a poem by Arnold which comes to my mind right now in all these misbegotten ways that we try to stabilize and have things be the way they should be. It's the acknowledgement that, yes, we are here on this darkling plane, swept by confused alarms of struggle and flight while ignorant armies fight by night. Yes, we're here. And we don't know what to do. We're getting overwhelmed. We don't know what to do about being on this darkling plane if we look towards right and wrong. If we look towards bad and good. Have you listened to people recently about what's good and what's bad and the nonsense about what we should do? It's like, I don't know, sociopathic cartoons. You know, just being spouted out from people's, you know, build a wall around Mexico, build a wall around Mexico. Yeah. I don't know. But there's a distilling capacity within one to feel that compassion that's related to what's referred to as the basis of suffering, which is the ignorance. The basis of suffering is the ignorance of craving, clinging, and grasping. And that sense of the ability to recognize, oh, well, this is this misbegotten whatever is born of ignorance, and it's not meant to be a statement of condensation. What am I trying to say? When you look down at something. Condescension. Condescending. It's not to be meant to be condescending. It's that the heart opens to, yes, this is the suffering of ignorance. It makes no sense. And this is what Upanindita was referring to. Remembering otherwise madness. Remember intention. When I hear something that doesn't make sense and gives rise to fear, what is the intention with this hearing? Because what equanimity allows is for this concentrated energy of consciousness to begin to become embodied here, within breathing and within a sensibility of consciousness that arises, that is endowed with skill and means, or the knowing of the responses that one can cultivate that come from equanimity. Like choosing to breathe. I've taken on the practice because it just seems to make so much sense within the view of breathing with life. Breathing with life in all forms, because every form is a life form. Every sound, every sight, every olfactory experience, everything that can be experienced as a life form, and that our entire experience of life is informed by one of the six sense doors. And if we're not here to receive life, if we're not here to receive breathing and awareness, not here to receive the data that comes through seeing and hearing and tasting and touching and such, then essentially discernment doesn't exist. And so our practice builds up a cohesive quality of energy that then begins to draw our attention so that we're living from the inside out. And when I say from the inside out, I mean from the very essential depths of what life is. Breathing. Life is breathing. Life isn't as clearly defined through restlessness. Life, in terms of confusion, is defined by restlessness and fighting against it. Whereas in clarity, life is defined through breathing. Breathing with you, I breathe with you in this moment. It brings one's attention into neutrality. I refuse to breathe with this world. And these thoughts do arise in aversion, because aversion is a defense of fear. I will not breathe with you. Oh, really? Well, what does that do? Deprives the brain of oxygen and, you know, and so forth and so on. So this taking on this practice to be willing to remember the intention to breathe with life and to cultivate that which is born of these dormant sensibilities that live in the heart is one way of understanding the Buddhist teachings, that we awaken that which is dormant within, that then brings about a transition in view so that we can truly live this life in a way that's informed, in a manner that is arising out of greater and greater clarity. I experienced a moment of clarity the other day, and I mean this, you know, like 2 days ago, where for the first time the Dhamma of despair arose in clarity. And the Dhamma of despair, like all mind states, we call everything Dhamma because there's inherent lawfulness, but suffering, it just was very, very clear that there was an emptying out of the perseveration and the ruminations associated with despair. And despair generates many, many of our thoughts that hold us within the experience that we cannot live life, is too painful. I found that thought. It came to the heart. It came to the heart with such a degree of utter pain that I was grateful because finally it arrived in consciousness. I would hear its echo, I would see, but right here. And I'm reminded in this moment of a part of a poem by Emily Dickinson. It goes, "There is a pain so utter that it covers the abyss with trance." This was a moment of awakening. I'm so grateful. Clarity is our highest value. We practice for the sake of practicing, so that which awakens within our practice, equanimity, allows for this distilling of the storehouse consciousness that is held and functioning and manifesting our lives in a way that I call haunted, that we're all haunted. You know, I've been haunted by despair all my life. Never taken by it. Never held by it and thrown into oblivion. But I have been haunted by it. Equanimity is that quality of consciousness that allows for us to offer what we have to life in the form of our attention. And it's a very, very interesting way that our practice awakens just simple experiences that we would not otherwise consider. Just simple experiences like one of the practices that I've taken on is to hear that which I don't want to hear and see what I don't want to look at. Equanimity has invited this practice into consciousness. And it's so interesting how that works. Because by holding an intention, there's a pause that occurs, a stillness, at that point where there is an averting of something, a defending of something, not wanting something to be a part of life's experience. And there's a kind of intimacy that comes into the heart as it opens to choose, okay, yes, just this moment to see. I had an experience. I was driving out of our co-op in Ashland, Oregon, where I live. And it was dusk. It was 9 o'clock, a little bit after, because it had just closed. And so I was driving out of the driveway, and there was one car in front of me who paused and then drove on. And so I came to the street and paused. But I didn't drive on, because I saw this body lying with its head on the sidewalk, concrete of the sidewalk, and its feet in the road. So I am practicing seeing what I don't want to see. So I looked. It was a male body, it seemed, and I asked, "Are you okay?" I mean, it's like, I'm fine. But, you know, it was like this body was arranged and hands to the head on both sides. I have water. So I said, "Well, is there anything I can do for you? I'm fine." I thought, well, I drove on. But I couldn't leave. I couldn't leave. I had to listen a little bit more. I had looked, but I hadn't listened. So I drove back around and came to the same position where I was, and I said, "Do you want some water?" He says, "I'm fine." I said, "No, I don't think you're fine. You're lying with your head on the sidewalk and your feet in the road. I don't think you're fine." So he sat up. I got his attention. And I said, "What's going on?" He said, "I drove in today with a friend, and my friend took off with all of my gear. I don't have any ID. I don't have any money. I don't have any backpack. I don't have a sleeping bag." And I thought, he's saying he doesn't have anything other than the clothes on his back. So I said, "Well, you know, there are people down in the plaza who are very much in your position, but they have basics, you know, and I'd be happy if you wanted to get in the car and to take you down there, you know, to introduce you to them." And these are, of course, the people who live on the street. And a lot of them are there just out of adventure, you know, Kerouac, you know. They don't know who he is, but some are there because they're veterans. Some are there because they're mentally ill, but there's a whole community, and they have different places that they sleep and they take care of themselves. And I found this out one day by looking and listening. And so I said, well, get in the car, you know, and I can drive you down and introduce you to some people that you might feel comfortable with. So he got in the car, and so I asked him questions. I said, where are you from? Well, I'm from Wairika. I said, may I call somebody for you? He said, there's no one that cares about me. So I'm thinking, clothes on his back, no ID, nothing. It became more and more empty. And I perceived this empty, despairing being. He says, I don't know what to do. I said, I don't know either. So we drove around until we came to the plaza. And I got out, and I said hi, and, you know, a couple people that I had looked and listened to in the past. And I said, I have someone who's lost, and I'm bringing him to you. And so this guy says, yeah, you know, we'll take care of him. And I said, well, what's your name? He said, Noodle. So I had the great honor of introducing Billy to Noodle. They connected immediately in compassion. That's all I knew to do. But my cosmic hug and my wish for this individual was that the simple possibilities of life might continue to unfold for us, so that that transition from don't know what to do and therefore go unconscious to the simplest responses that come from the heart, that come from equanimity. Just tiny little responses. It isn't about saving the world. That's a dream. It's a part of the trance that covers the abyss. But what happens as we begin to go more and more deeply and comfortably into practicing for the sake of our practice is that we begin to recognize that this is how it is that equanimity arises. And this spaciousness of heart, this kindness opens so that we can begin to see clearly and to begin to choose to unbind our senses and our sensibilities in a way that allows for us to just live within this life in a manner that allows for possibility, humble, simple possibilities. I'll close by saying that when I was a little girl in Japan and I saw cherry blossoms are hugely symbolically powerful in Japan, and there's a festival, and this is mirrored, you know, in Cherry Blossom Festival in Washington, D.C. And I was watching these pink blossoms just go everywhere, and it came to my mind that they were like tears. Beautiful, beautiful tears. And there were so many, and I realized, oh, these are the tears that have been cried throughout infinite time. You can't count them. And then later I heard that Kuan Yin, a mythological figure in Buddhism, but nonetheless, is the hearer of cries. Her heart is open. And in some cultures, Kuan Yin is a male. His heart is open to hearing. And so sometimes when we see a statue of Kuan Yin, not always. This one's in repose, showing us. I'm not even sure it's Kuan Yin, actually. But, you know, I'm at ease. Oftentimes, Kuan Yin holds a vase, and it's pouring out of the tears that have been cried throughout infinite time. I ask myself, how deeply can I live in the heart? And the only way I know in to answer that question in any given moment is by allowing it to breathe. And within that, to find the balance and the spaciousness that allows for one, myself, to be awake in any given moment in the simplest way, right here, right now. Perhaps there's been something in this desana. The desana is a term for, it's a Thai forest term for Dhamma talk, means nutrient. Perhaps there's been something in this desana or reflection that's touched into where your practice is growing and making more sense out of your life. In which case, perhaps we can share a few moments of noble silence. Perhaps remembering to choose to breathe with life in this moment. Breathing from the inside out. May it be so. May I say that for those who are interested in the day long, it again will be focused in sati and upekkha or equanimity. And I'll offer a clear definition of what it is in a way that is applicable within our practice. I'll reflect on the seven supports for equanimity so we can recognize that they are functioning within us. And as well, in the latter part of the day, I will offer the actual concentration practice that's related to the cultivation of equanimity. And then on Sunday, when we come back together, it will be sitting in inquiry so that we take our experience of our practice and we dialogue it, we inquire. This is how it is that we break down the barriers between our practice and life. And we begin to see that they are unified. So if you have the time and inclination, I would love to see you and sit with you.